sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Dr. Richard Ablin, the discoverer of the PSA test for prostate cancer, and the author of the new book, The Great Prostate Hoax. We'll also have a visit from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. You may or may not have heard the news, but the new Pope Francis I is going to be visiting Israel next week, arriving for a whirlwind 24-hour visit to Jerusalem on May 25th, next Sunday. This sort of marks the 50th anniversary of the first papal visit to Israel back in 1964 by then Pope Paul VI, way back before the Vatican actually recognized the State of Israel, even before Vatican II's Nostra Aetate Declaration changed the relationship of the Catholic Church and the Jewish people dramatically for the better. Well, we here at Two Jewish certainly welcome Pope Francis's visit to Israel. He's also going to Jordan and the Palestinian Authority, and we welcome his open and very positive attitude towards everyone, including, I think, almost especially the Jewish community. His well-documented close friendship and co-authorship of a book with a prominent Argentine rabbi, Abraham Skorka, have certainly been noted very positively by Jews all around the world. I must say that within my own lifetime, the relationship between the Roman Catholic Church and Israel, as well as between the Church and the Jewish communities around the world, has improved remarkably, and this papal visit should further that development even more. Rabbi Skorka will actually be going along with the Pope on his trip to Israel, perhaps helping to smooth the way a bit. You can make a pretty good case, however, that the current relationship between the Catholic Church and Israel, as well as the Church's relations with the Jews of Rome itself, have never been better in our long shared history. Of course, in a way, this is damning by faint praise, because the actual history of the Jewish people in the Roman Catholic Church has been a tortured one. It is quite wonderful to live in an era in which that is no longer true, in which the Pope and the entire enormous structure of the Church has worked hard to reach out to Jews, to recognize and atone for the Shoah, and to respect the importance and authenticity of Judaism itself. And that was and remains particularly important, because it would be folly to deny that for many centuries the Roman Catholic Church and many of its popes was the source of some of the most virulent anti-Semitic statements and publications and the worst acts of persecution, torture, and murder of Jews in all of human history. That this is no longer the case after something like 18 centuries of church-fueled anti-Semitism is a kind of modern-day miracle. Without reviewing the grim record in detail from Constantine on out, historically the Church's record of behavior towards Jews and the anti-Semitic character of many papal bulls and the patristic writings of the Church Fathers was a source of most of the anti-Jewish legislation and much of the horrible stereotyping and Jew-baiting that made Europe a charnel house of evil for our people for so long. If you consider the conduct of the Church during such diverse periods as the Crusades, the Inquisition, even in America, the anti-Semite Father Coughlin in the 1930s, you could easily come to the conclusion that Catholics have hated Jews always and have consistently treated us with violence and brutality. This may not have been everyone, but this painful history has left many scars, and there are lots of older Jews and some younger ones who cannot conceive of Catholicism or the Pope without associating both with that history of persecution. Today, however, we are fortunate to live in an era in which, as a congregational rabbi, I've had the privilege of being friends with the Bishop of Tucson and have had long, close relationships with priests, nuns, monsignors, Catholic laity, and the previous bishop of blessed memory. I've been privileged to host many Catholic leaders at my temple and on our Bema, and to speak and participate in services, classes, and other events, both in individual Catholic churches at the diocesan level and at the cathedral. I feel the kinship of a fellowship of faith with most of the priests I know, regardless of our theological difference, and I have enjoyed working and studying with many of them. It is impossible not to feel good about a pope like Francis, who reaches out to Jews. Nobody calling on the phone, except for the pope may be in Rome. All of this positive action from the pope is in the post-Vatican II Catholic Church. I believe that church, from the Pope on down, has worked extremely hard to build bridges with Jews and in recent decades with Israel. It continues to do important work coming to terms with the Holocaust, the Shoah, and the ways in which the church met that challenge as well as it could have, and the ways in which it failed to do so. The Catholic Church's self-renovation since Vatican II is a remarkable and powerful lesson in the way that tshuva, repentance, can be effectuated even within a huge, ancient, traditional institution. And I welcome it, as do almost all Jews, and as will many Israelis next weekend. And so I've joined in an ad with many other rabbis and Jewish leaders in formally welcoming the Pope to Israel, our eternal homeland. May this steadily growing relationship continue to develop in respectful and mutually supportive ways. And may the warmth and openness of Pope Francis and his apparent understanding of Judaism and Jews in this post-Holocaust era serve both of our faiths in helping to improve this troubled world. To play us in this morning, in part in tribute to the Argentinian Pope, here's the remarkable Argentinian Jewish musician Yehuda Glantz, who lives in Israel now, playing on the charango stringed instrument, singing Adon Olam, his own composition in Buenos Aires. Adon Olam, asher malach, peterekol yitzir nivra, lechaza mechetzokol, azay melech shemonika, ve'acharei kiklot hakol, lepato vimloch nora, ve'u haya ve'u oven, ve'u ye ve'tifara. That was Yehuda Glantz, the Argentinian, chassid, singing and playing Adon Olam, the concluding hymn in many services to the Lord of the World. Our guest this morning is one of the top medical scientists in the world in the area of the prostate. He's the discoverer and inventor of the PSA test for prostate cancer. He will explain to us why this test and many treatments are now radically overused by the big medical industry, and how in many cases the cure is actually much worse than the disease. Meet Dr. Richard Ablin, learn about the big prostate hoax, his new book, when we return on Too Jewish.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU, dream it, do it, visit asu.edu.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We welcome to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Dr. Richard Ablin. He is the author of a new book, The Great Prostate Hoax. He's also largely responsible for the PSA test that has been so widely applied, or you might say so widely misapplied, in determining the state of prostate cancer and the prevalence of prostate cancer in males, not only in America, but around the world. Good morning, Dick. Welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi Cohen.
So you really created the research that led to the PSA test, which is sort of a tremendous credit to your medical skill and your research skill. You now believe it is widely misinterpreted and widely misapplied. Tell us a little bit about why that happened and how it all works.
So I discovered PSA in 1970. Shortly after I discovered it, at the time I was looking for what we call a protein or an antigen, which is cancer specific. And when I found this protein, which we call PSA, which stands for prostate specific antigen, when I found that this was present in a normal gland and in a gland that men after the age of 40, we develop what's called BPH, which is an acronym for benign prostatic hypertrophy. That's the reason why in many cases as we get older, we tend to get up once or twice or three times a night to urinate because we don't empty our bladders.
I don't know anything you're talking about. I never heard of that before.
Right. And the third is cancer of the prostate. So what we found was that because this protein is present only in the prostate gland, irrespective of whether it's normal, benign, or malignant, that if you removed the prostate gland, you took away the source of the protein. So therefore, where it was very useful as what we call a harbinger for the recurrence of the disease. Example is a man has a surgical removal of the prostate, which is referred to as a radical prostatectomy. He has radiation. So the prostate is either removed surgically or it's destroyed by radiation. So therefore, the source of the protein, which is found in the blood, should be gone or should be at a very low level.
Right.
So where this protein was useful and still is useful is that if the man is following treatment for prostate cancer, if the level in the serum or the blood rises, that's a suggestion that either one, they didn't get all of the cancer, and or possibly at the time the man was diagnosed, he had metastasis. In other words, the cancer had already spread,
right?
But it was below the level of the method for detection. All right, so that's generally used. And in 1986, the Food and Drug Administration approved this test for that purpose, as to look at the prognosis or for the recurrence of disease.
So we will talk much more with Dr. Richard Ablin about the PSA test, about the test for prostate cancer, how it's now very widely used and probably widely overused, and some of the consequences of that when we come back this morning on Two Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is the cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, compliment, comment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center in Tucson. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So the peace process has flopped, according to all reports from everywhere. President Obama says maybe it's okay to take a break. It does seem like nothing productive is kind of going forward. How do you think Israelis generally feel about that?
I can speak only for the, you know, people, the resident, not the government, of course. And I'm one of them, very disappointed, very frustrated, really wish like a different environment to raise my kids when we will get back to Israel. And I still have the dream that, you know, by the time that my girls will be old enough, we don't need Tzava. We don't need IDF anymore.
They don't have to go in the army.
Yeah, I wish. To be serious for a moment.
They would be very cute soldiers if they have to be, but it would be much better if they weren't.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, we are sharing the frustration and we really, really, and I told you once at one of the shows that I really hope and feel that secure that this peace process will bear some fruit. So I'm really disappointed with all the what's happened for the last 2 weeks with all the, you know, flip-flop or I don't know.
Flip-flopping and the criticism and the negativity and right.
It will take, like the Mashiach, who will wait, I hope not too long, but I hope that, you know, this peace process will start again or we will have, I don't know, a miracle, a ness.
So a ness is always something worth believing in because Israel itself is a ness, a miracle. Do you think Israelis are surprised at the failure of this peace process?
No, I think I was one of the minority that was surprised because I really, really hoped. But no, unfortunately, no.
Too many times and too much disagreement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I hope that in the coming year, some revival will take place and maybe there'll be a turn for the better on both sides, really, because peace can't be made on one side.
Nachon. Yeah. I hope that on one of the upcoming shows, we can celebrate the breakthrough on the peace process here.
From your mouth to
Amen.
God's ears. Amen. Yeah. Thanks, Oshrat. We'll talk next week.
Yeah.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none.
From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, Russia and Ukraine have been very much in the news over the last several months, ever since the end of the Olympics when Russia moved to take over the Crimea. Jews are worried. There still are a lot of Jews, actually, in Ukraine and, of course, in Russia and in other former Soviet republics that now are getting nervous. What does this mean for anti-Semites? And, you know, the sort of classic question, what does this mean for the Jews?
Right. It is a classic question. And let's go, if it's all right with you, from the general to the particular here,
sure,
instead of the opposite direction. General direction is, so the course I teach most regularly at the University of Arizona is a course for undergrads on the history of anti-Semitism. And we were just recently approaching the end of the semester. And several of my students expressed the notion that, well, surely after the Holocaust, there was no more anti-Semitism in Europe because they realized the horrors that can be created by giving vent to primitive prejudices and antagonisms. And I said, well, you know what? There are neo-Nazis, there are extreme right movements in many countries where it seems that maybe anti-Semitism hibernated for a while, but it certainly hasn't disappeared. And those countries, and this is not a reason to boycott travel there or anything else, but those countries include friendly Western-oriented countries like France and Germany and Hungary, as well as possibly less friendly former Soviet bloc countries such as the Russian Federation and Ukraine. I mean, you see evidences of active anti-Semitism, painting swastikas on tombstones,
right.
Attacks on Jewish community centers, on Jewish kids going to school, whatever, in pretty much any country in Europe, unless it's a country that has no Jews or is a country with amazingly high levels of social harmony, like most of the Nordic countries. You know, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, you don't really see this there. But you do see it in the larger, more Central European countries.
And the more cosmopolitan places, I might add, and the more diverse populations.
Well, although you'd be surprised at the size of the Arab population of Norway or the Pakistani population of Denmark. I mean, surprisingly, even small towns in Denmark, I was once in this town called Aarhus, and it has an amazingly diverse population. We think of these countries as very homogeneous. They're not really so much. But spending time in them shows clearly that anti-Semitism in Europe is not a thing of the past. It's rooted in folklore, in national consciousness, and it is sometimes used, particularly by extremist parties of the right, to whip up a frenzy of nationalism or acceptance for a particular government or a particular agenda based on hate. And, you know, hate crimes are hate crimes wherever they occur and whatever the target of them is. And we need to be wary. I think that's one of the lessons of both Passover and this general period of the year of counting the Omer and leading up to Shavuot is we need to be wary, but not too wary. And I think maybe next week we'll come to the sort of too wary scenario.
Thanks, Tom. We will explore that next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A rabbi dies and goes to heaven. As he's approaching the gates, he hears a band singing and dancing. Angels approach, and he begins to get very excited. But then the lead angel comes up to the rabbi and asks if he'd step aside for a moment. Shocked, the rabbi does. The angels march out of the gates and encircle a man who is also approached. When the rabbi looks closely, he realizes the guy is a humble Eged bus driver. The joyous parade of angels and the band carry the bus driver on their shoulders into heaven ahead of the rabbi. When the parade is gone, one angel wanders back to the rabbi and says, "Okay, you can come in now." And then he starts to go inside. The rabbi, confused, says, "Hey, Angel, I'm not one to make waves, but I need to know something. I've been a good rabbi. I've worked hard all my life to help people, to teach people. How is it that the egghead bus driver gets led in by a band of angels and I have to walk in alone?" And the angel says, "Well, frankly, Rabbi, whenever you preached, people slept. But when he drove, people prayed." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. By the way, at the recent Israel festival here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, a guy came up to me and said, "Rabbi, enjoy your show, but you've got to do something about those terrible jokes." Oh well, maybe next week. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bamidbar, first in the book of Numbers, which is given its name for the census that occupies a good part of the beginning of the Torah portion. Superficially, it's just a listing of names and numbers and not a very interesting text for study or inspiration. But it also teaches us a primary lesson. Every human being counts in God's eyes and should similarly count in our eyes as well. There's an unusual phrase in the beginning of the portion. The survey is to be taken of the whole nation, and b'mispar shemot, by the numbering of names. In other words, even though by definition a census is an accounting, a totaling of sums, each individual is to be accounted for not by number, but by name. Each person has a unique identity, a human face. Each is an image of God. The notion that every human being counts is part of our tradition in many ways, from the requirement to have 10 Jewish adults for a minyan to the requirement that we must view every other person as a tzelem Elohim, an image of God no different from ourselves in holiness. The Talmud tells us that one who saved a single life is accounted the merit of having saved the whole world. Each of us is counted because we all count. Paradoxically, even counting itself can be transformed into an affirmation of that sanctity. In this period between Pesach and Shavuot, we count each day of the Omer as a kind of special preparation, remembering the connection between freedom and covenant. We count each day so that we may make each day count. And when we do the tabulation that lets us know that we have the 10 required for a minyan, traditionally, we don't count by numbers, since that would devalue each human being into being a mere digit. Instead, we find a verse from the Bible that has 10 words and work our way through it until we have completed the passage, thus making every member of that accounting into part of a sacred sentence. In a world of numbers, it's comforting to realize that we are each much more than mere sums of our parts. No matter how we seek to quantify or digitize our world, each one of us, you especially, matters to God. And that is worth recounting again and again. When we return in a few moments, Dr. Richard Ablin, the discoverer of the PSA test for prostate cancer and a renowned expert on the subject, will tell you why his own test is now so completely overused, why a diagnosis of prostate cancer is not nearly as terrifying as many doctors make it sound. Learn what you should and shouldn't do, and how the medical industry continues to cause a great deal of harm in this sensitive area. His book is called The Great Prostate Hoax. It's new, and learn all about it when we come back on Too Jewish.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU. Dream it. Do it. Visit asu.edu.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world, with commentary.
Aseinu, aseinu,
While this week we read the Torah portion of Bamidbar, a census, there is a new census out. About a quarter of the world's population agrees that a number of negative statements about Jews are probably true, according to an Anti-Defamation League poll aimed at providing a statistical basis to the question of just how widespread anti-Semitism is globally. This survey was released last week. It covered 101 countries and the Palestinian territories. 26% of respondents agreed with at least 6 of 11 negative statements, what the ADL says are stereotypes about Jews. Those questions include, Jews are more loyal to Israel than their home country, and Jews have too much power in the business world. The poll was sponsored by the ADL, the leading organization for fighting anti-Semitism and other prejudice, and it was funded by a New York business leader and philanthropist named Leonard Stern. First International Resources did the poll. It conducted 53,000 interviews in 96 languages. It was the most extensive survey ever taken on anti-Semitism. The Anti-Defamation League says its goal was to create a snapshot of anti-Semitic views in all parts of the world, to find ways to combat it, to allow future surveys to measure whether and where the prejudice is rising or falling. Abe Foxman, the ADL's national director and a past guest of Too Jewish, said he was taken aback that anti-Semitism remains so prevalent. You would think that 70 years after the Holocaust, with all the marvels of communication and of greater openness, it would be low, said Foxman, who has worked for the ADL since 1965, has headed the group since 1987, and is retiring soon. Maybe it's not shocking, but it's sobering. The only religious group with a higher unfavorability rating in the survey than Jews was Muslims. While 38% rated Jews favorably and 21% unfavorably, both numbers were higher for Muslims. 47% rated Muslims favorably and 24% rated them unfavorably. In comparison, Christians did very well. 62% rated them favorably, just 15% unfavorably. Countries in the Middle East and North Africa, which generally have a contentious relationship with Israel, have by far the highest proportion of people responding with anti-Semitic views, averaging 74%. Outside that region, Greece had the highest percentage of anti-Semitism. 69% of the people affirmed 6 or more anti-Semitic statements. Anti-Semitism and other forms of prejudice rise during times of economic hardship. Greece has been struggling with this downturn. The extreme party Golden Dawn, which blames Jews and other minorities for the country's woes, has made significant political inroads. South Korea's results show that negative views of Jews aren't necessarily tied to even having Jews in the country. 53% of those surveyed in South Korea affirmed 6 or more anti-Semitic statements, and the country has perhaps 100 total Jews. The survey's findings didn't all support anti-Semitic views. While 26% agreed with 6 or more of the anti-Semitic statements, 28%, more than that, didn't believe that any of them were true. In the U.S., just 9% of those surveyed subscribed to 6 of the 11 anti-Semitic statements, giving us one of the lowest levels of anti-Semitism in the whole world. Good news. The U.S. is the only country where the ADL has conducted such surveys for many years. The figure has dropped from 29% in the first survey back in 1964, 50 years ago. In spite of the results from South Korea, somewhat nearby Laos was the least anti-Semitic country in the world in the new poll, with 0.2% of the population exhibiting such views. Perhaps they just don't know what Jews are. In any case, good for Laos. And in other news, although it's pretty common when dictators get overthrown, it's not every former head of state in a democracy who ends up in prison. But Ehud Olmert, the former wunderkind of Israeli politics and Israel's prime minister from 2006 to 2009, as well as the mayor of Jerusalem before that from 1993 to 2003, was sentenced to prison for 6 years last week for the crime of bribery. He was also fined 1 million shekels by the Israeli court, about $250,000. Olmert, who shot to national prominence at the age of 21 when he publicly challenged Menachem Begin at a political party conference, was a Golani Brigade soldier and a wounded one, and later an officer, a successful lawyer, and was elected to Knesset at the age of 28. Throughout his long and generally successful political career, Olmert has been dogged by accusations of financial corruption, including official investigations that began way back in the mid-1980s. This time, he has finally been convicted and now sentenced. Olmert, whose family and initial political experience was on the right wing of Israeli politics, gradually moved towards the center during his career. He followed Ariel Sharon from Likud in forming the Kadima Party and later succeeded Sharon when Sharon had his debilitating stroke in early 2006. The failure of the 2006 Lebanon War was mostly blamed on Olmert, but he remained in office until 2009, coming ever so close to a deal with the Palestinians in Annapolis, Maryland, back in 2007, a deal that was partly undermined by a corruption investigation even then. Olmert also led Israel during the Gaza fighting of 2008-2009, and perhaps most importantly today, he ordered the bombing of the secret Syrian nuclear project and prevented Bashar al-Assad's Syria from having an atomic bomb right now. Olmert's sentencing is a sad day in Israeli politics. But of course, it is yet more proof that Israel is a country of justice in which no one is above the law, including a prime minister or even an ex-prime minister. While we certainly should feel some shame for Olmert's conduct, we must also note the contrast with the executions, show trials, civil wars, despotism, and institutionalized corruption that blacken the leadership of each of Israel's Arab and Palestinian neighbors. Finally, in other news from the Middle East, Israel offered last week to help Turkey with anything it needs in order to respond to the coal mine disaster that left almost 250 miners dead and hundreds more trapped inside a mine in western Turkey. At times of tragedy, we must all do what we can to help one another. We have offered Turkey whatever assistance it requires at this time, President Shimon Peres said in a letter to Turkish President Abdullah Gül. We are shocked at the loss of life of innocent people at work, and our thoughts are with the people of Turkey, wrote Peres. We pray for the victims, their families, for the rescue of those still trapped, and the full recovery of the injured. Indeed, we do. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Dr. Richard Ablin. He's a professor in the Department of Pathology, University of Arizona College of Medicine, the Arizona Cancer Center, and the Bio 5 Institute. He's also the president of the Ablin Foundation for Cancer Research, founded in memory of his father. He is largely responsible for the development of the PSA test that has detected prostate cancer in so many men, and believes that to a great extent it has been, well, let me just give the title of the book, The Great Prostate Hoax, How Big Medicine Hijacked the PSA Test and Caused a Public Health Disaster. Welcome back. You started earlier the show explaining what the PSA test measures, how it can tell if cancer has metastasized or was missed in the initial testing. Let's talk about how that test is used and how widely it's applied today.
Okay, so as I mentioned, the first use of the test is for prognosis or recurrence of disease following treatment. Now, in 1994, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, made a critical mistake, and that is they approved this test, extended it to use for the detection of prostate cancer, meaning that if they found a certain level of this protein in the blood, they said that this would be a criteria for doing subsequent examinations and possible treatment, and that this indicated that you had, in fact, prostate cancer. Now, the difficulty with this is if you recall a few minutes ago, I explained that while this protein is specific for the prostate gland and not found in the kidney or the liver or anywhere else, it's not cancer specific. So therefore, if you were a truck driver and drove from LA to California and then had some blood drawn and they measured the level of PSA, anything that would disturb the prostate, you know, if you were, excuse me, Rabbi, if you were up all night in an orgy or some sort of sexual activity.
Not lately, anyway.
Okay. Then you would find that anything that disturbs the prostate, if you rode a bicycle,
right,
anything that disturbs the prostate would increase the level of PSA.
Hmm.
So that second use of the test, using it for the detection of cancer, is totally flawed. And the reasons for this are, is that one, it's not cancer specific. Two,
so it just detects irritation of the
level,
prostate,
right,
basically.
The level of PSA. Okay. The second reason is that because there's no level of PSA that's diagnostic for prostate cancer. For example, a man could have a level of 0.5 and have cancer, and could have a level of 11 and not have cancer. Now, if you have a level of 50 or 100 or 1,000, obviously that indicates that there's something wrong. Now, the third difficulty is that, and I think we talked about this a few years ago when I came back from Tanzania,
right,
and that is that the test cannot determine an indolent cancer or a latent cancer from an aggressive cancer. What this means is that prostate cancer is an age-related disease. And if we look at the levels of prostate cancer occurring in men starting at age 20, every 10 years, the incidence of prostate cancer increases. So if we're doing a biopsy on a man that's between 60 and 69 years of age, 65% of the time we will find that man has cancer. But the question is the cancer an indolent or a latent cancer that is never ever going to have any clinical consequences, and that he'll die from cardiovascular disease or some other disease? Or will the disease go on to progress?
I think you talk about the difference between the turtle and the rabbit.
Right, and so I try to analogize that if you have an open box and you have a turtle and a rabbit in it, the turtle crawls around the box and goes nowhere, and you die with prostate cancer, which is the majority of the cases, because only 3% of men die from prostate cancer. So on the other hand, if you have the rabbit symbolizes the aggressive form. So the rabbit can jump out of the box at any time and spread to other parts of the body. So the fourth problem, I call these cruxes of the second use of the test, is that if you go to your urologist and you have a certain level of PSA, for a number of years they use the level 4, which when we, you know, it's similar to cholesterol or triglycerides when you go to your doctor. So if you had a level of 4, then they said that there was a possibility that you had cancer. And then they would do an ultrasound, which is putting something similar to a big fat Jewish hot dog in your rectum. It's the ultrasound probe looking at a TV screen, seeing whether there were certain areas that looked suspicious,
right,
and then do a biopsy. And so then when you do the biopsy, you come up with the difficulty, is it a rabbit or a turtle? So for those four reasons, the PSA test can be used to follow when you're treated, but it does more harm when it's being used to try to detect cancer. Now, the reason why I say it's more harm is because the consequences of a radical prostatectomy are a high level of incontinence, your inability to control
your bladder,
urine, and impotency. You know, not to be, you know, when a lot of urologists, you know, when a patient says, well, you know, I can deal, you know, they say they can deal with the incontinence, but I can't deal with the impotency. And then, you know, the urologist will say to them, well, you know, John, there's no sex in heaven. you know, they, a lot of urologists are really insensitive. I mean, you see a 55 or 60-year-old man who has to change
everything about
diapers,
right,
10 times a day and is dripping. And also, in certain cases, you know, men and women have their own perspective, you know, their personalities.
Sure.
And the man, the psychological stress, you know, of a man who becomes impotent and cannot have intercourse, you know, with his wife or a significant other. So there's the physical attributes and the psychological attributes.
So in essence, the medical industry, probably no other way to term it, has adopted PSA as a diagnostic test for people who haven't ever been diagnosed with cancer when it's not at all appropriate for that. And it should only be used if someone clearly has had cancer and has had treatment, and then it's a good indicator of what might need to happen. Why has it become so prevalent, and why is it, as you say, a kind of a hoax? You know, the PSA test is widely prescribed.
Yeah, this is what the book, The Great Prostate Hoax, it takes from the beginning. It has nothing to do, it doesn't matter who discovered PSA.
Well, it's you, but
right,
go ahead.
Right, but I'm just saying, what's important is, how did a test that could never do what it's purported to do, how could it reach the trillion-dollar industry worldwide that it is? And how it reached that pinnacle is that physicians, you know, there's all sorts of physicians, there's all sorts of, you know, there's all sorts of lawyers, there's all sorts of car mechanics, there's all sorts of rabbis.
Rabbis too, right?
Right, right. So what happened is that the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry, specifically urologists, they placed greed over patient care. For example, Kimberly Clark, who manufactures Depend. If you go into Costco here, sometimes you'll see on the wall all the way up to the ceiling, Depend. They sponsor. There's support groups out there for, like there are for breast or other types of diseases. There are support groups for prostate cancer where men go and meet with other men. They have speakers and they discuss prostate cancer and the consequences and so forth and so on. Some of the support groups, such as us too, they're supported by about 35 different industrial firms because they have a vested interest in this. Man to Man, which was a support group by the American Cancer Society, subsequently suspended their activities because they begun to realize that this test does more harm. In fact, the United States Preventative Services Task Force, a couple of years ago, you may have remember reading in the paper, shortly after I had an opinion in the New York Times.
New York Times, right.
Yeah, that they came up and said that PSA screening for prostate cancer does more harm than good. A couple of points I just want to emphasize quickly is that the thing that, as the book details and names names and institutions, the test, as I mentioned, was approved in 1986 to follow a man who was treated. Okay. However, the urologists and the pharmaceutical industry began manufacturing this test kit.
Is that a needle biopsy kit?
No, this is where they draw blood.
Where they actually draw blood. Okay.
And they do a test in the laboratory. So the thing that's important here to realize is that while the test was approved in 86 for recurrence of the disease, this test was used off-label, illegally, for 8 years, from 86 to 94, for testing men for prostate cancer, and caused a tsunami in the increase of radical prostatectomies, even in men 70 and 75.
So to summarize a little bit, if you do happen to have prostate cancer, you're very typical, because I think I saw in some of your statistics, for men in their 70s who die from other causes unrelated to anything related to prostate cancer, the vast majority, something like 80%, had some form of prostate cancer that didn't have anything to do with their illness. In other words, it was sort of the turtle style. and that this epidemic of use of the PSA test to see if men had prostate cancer has led to all kinds of radical prostatectomies that were completely unnecessary. What can people do about this?
All right, so here the situation is this. A decision to have a PSA test, irrespective of what I have to say, what I've said in the past for almost 30 years trying to educate people, what I said in the Times and what I say in my book, the actual decision whether to have a PSA test or not is between a man and his physician. It's up to the physician to discuss with the patient the pros and the cons of the PSA test. And given that discussion, if the patient still wants to have the test, he's entitled to have the test. So the other thing is that if you're over 40 and you had a first-degree relative, for example, if your father had prostate cancer, there's twice the possibility that you'll have prostate cancer. If you have a brother that had prostate cancer, it's three times the possibility. So if you're in one of those groups where you have
higher risk group,
then what you may want to do is you may want to have a PSA test with the understanding that what you do is that you write the number down, since there is no dichotomy in the response, meaning there's no high, there's no low.
Right.
You write the number down. And then next year when you go for your physical,
you have the blood test that gives
again,
the PSA.
And then what you do is
compare the numbers.
Is you compare the numbers. And I like to try to make the analogy, although I don't know how good it is between a smoke alarm and a fire alarm. If a smoke alarm goes off, you know, it could mean, with no disrespect, I don't know how your cooking is, but that you might be in the kitchen cooking.
That's right.
All right. So the idea here is that if your level of PSA starts to climb, that's a smoke alarm. It's telling you that your prostate, which is susceptible to prostatitis, which is an infection or due to diet, or benign prosthetic hypertrophy with aging, getting larger, or cancer, that's saying that something's going on in my prostate. So now what I should do is I should go to the urologist, go to my doctor, tell my doctor what's happening, and he go to the urologist and discuss with the urologist what it is, and then investigate it from there. Too often what's happened is that they have these screening clinics, and they have them here in Tucson, where on a weekend you go to wherever it may be at Carondelet Hospital or UMC or someplace, and they draw your blood and they do a digital rectal exam. And then a week later, they contact you and they say your level of PSA was 4.5. The normal is 4, which is not the case. And we recommend that you see your urologist. And then you start down the road.
The slippery slope, as it were.
Right. So the best thing to do is, if you have no symptoms, you have no blood in your urine, you have no back pain, you have no pains in your leg, you have no blood in your urine,
right.
You have no pain on ejaculation, you don't have any symptoms, and there's many others of prostate cancer, and you have a digital rectal exam where the urologist puts his finger up the rectum and feels for irregularities,
right.
And that's normal, and you don't have any family history of prostate cancer, you really shouldn't do anything.
It's a great recommendation. The book is The Great Prostate Hoax, which you can find online. Is there a website that people can go to find out more as well?
Well, the book is listed if they go to
Amazon.com
or Barnes & Noble. There's been several reviews that have come out on the book. And if one goes to Google, and puts in the name Abilene and Piana and the title, they'll pull up some of the reviews. Well, we're still hoping. The book is just out 4 weeks yesterday. These reviews are very nice, and we're very appreciative. And they're all 5-star, you know, when they use stars for them, they're all 5-star reviews. And in fact, yesterday at the Amazon.com website, the book was number one in the category of prosthetic diseases and urology, and number seven in healthcare.
It's a great start.
But what's happened is, unfortunately, is that, as you'll read the book yourself, mm-hmm. there's names, we name names.
Right.
And we name institutions.
Yep.
And these people are not going to be very happy.
Sure. But, you know, you need to tell the truth. It's a great Jewish principle. I want to thank Dr. Richard Ablin for a great visit. The book is called The Great Prostate Hoax, How Big Medicine Hijacked the PSA Test and Caused a Public Health Disaster. Thank you so much, Dick.
Well, I appreciate it, Rabbi Cohen. I had a chance to be on your program a few years ago, and I really especially appreciate the opportunity that I was invited back, which means I wasn't that bad the first
Absolutely
time.
Absolutely not.
No, you're no, great. And I hope everything that I said, as I said, you know, you really don't hear yourself.
No,
I hope some of it, I hope, if in anything, that at least some of it was clear and helped.
It was up. Indeed, and I think the more people know about this, the better. Thanks. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Josh Fatal, a Jewish author and one of three American hikers imprisoned in Iran for over a year and a half. His story is truly phenomenal. Don't miss hearing it next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our playout this morning comes in a kind of sacrilegious tribute to Pope Francis' coming visit to Israel. It's a very funny Jumunga star Sean Altman's quite ridiculous song, I'm Taller Than Jesus. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
I'm not bragging, don't mean to blaspheme, but Jesus was a short dude, at least compared to me. The average guy at the time of Christ was 4 foot.